truth.
Anything else that you'd like to add? Any sources for listeners to go to? Because this is so critical right now. We've got until, what, November 17th. That's the big date. Let's get on it, everybody. Once this is gone, it's gone. You're going to go to the beach, and there will be dead tide pools. That's all you need to know. What else? Where else can people go to keep up with this, Jody?
Well, we have a website, the citizensagainstlng.com. It was hacked a while back by a cyber attack, and I've been working trying to get it up to speed, and I haven't got it totally restored. So the best thing you can do is email citizens the email address there that's on the website, and get on my email list, and I email people updates. I'm going to try to get we're working on a plan to get the website up to speed so that it'll be current.
But and what they're commenting on here is proposal. It's A14-10 and A14-11. So
yes, if you go to the Coos County Planning Department website and look under pending applications and extend the filing little plus symbols for those two files, you will get all the information of what is currently being looked at to comment on.
That's about it, everyone. Thank you so much for that. My guest has been Jody McCaffrey, of course, with Citizens Against LNG. We're completely flat out of time. A lot of other stuff going on, though, naturally, on the Ebola, as the Ebola drama unfolds. There's a big action taking place up in British Columbia around Burnaby. This has been Cascadia for Monday, October 27th, 2014. My engineer today is Emily Young. Kathleen Stevenson is the KBOOAM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Chris Andre. Get the facts. Know your rights. Take a stand. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, disability awareness is off today. Coming up next, Locus Focus guest host Michelle Schroeder Fletcher speaks with journalist Catherine Miles about her book Superstorm, 9 days Inside Hurricane Sandy. That is coming up next at 11. Again, disability awareness is off today. Instead, we'll hear Food Sleuth Radio with guest Karen Collins, nutrition advisor to the American Institute for Cancer Research, explaining what we know and what we don't know about nutrition and cancer prevention. And 11:30 on Health and Healthcare Forum, host Roberta Hall and clinical dietitian Nancy Sullivan discuss a recent study on the negative health effects produced by artificial sweeteners. Very, very curious about that. Want to call folks and have them tune in. Again, that's 11:30 on Health and Healthcare Forum. Thank you again for your generous support, KBOO listeners. Stay tuned again for Michelle Schroeder Fletcher and Catherine Miles about her book, Superstorm.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 2014 Asada Shakur Solidarity Community Event on Sunday, November 2nd from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Center for Intercultural Organizing at 707 North Killingsworth Street in Portland. This event will have performances and talks from Portland's finest MCs, spoken word artists, and community organizers to reflect on Asada Shakur, former BLA political prisoner now exiled in Cuba. This event is in conjunction with the Jericho Movement's International Day of Solidarity with Asada and all political prisoners. Again, that's the 2014 Asada Shakur Solidarity Community Event, Sunday, November 2nd, 7 to 9 p.m. at the Center for Intercultural Organizing in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. Sitting in on the program for today, I'm Michelle Schroeder Fletcher, and you're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. A direct text from a friend of mine who's had a beach house for over 15 years. Quote, "Never seen a bigger storm here. Huge waves pounding the shore. House shaking, wind howling. Quite a show." After a week of wet and stormy weather and high winds, you might have memories and recollections of storms that you've experienced, but certainly nothing like October 29th, 2012, in which the largest Atlantic storm system ever recorded hit the Atlantic, Superstorm Sandy. Our guest today, Catherine Miles, has written a brand new book, 9 Days Inside Hurricane Sandy Superstorm. Catherine Miles serves as a writer-in-residence for Green Mountain College. Her article for Outside Magazine on one Hurricane Sandy story was named a must-read by New Yorker, Longform, and The Daily Beast. Her writing has also appeared in publications including America's Best Essays. Welcome.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Yes, Catherine, I guess I should ask, how's the weather where you are?
Well, I'm in the other Portland right now, and it's definitely starting to feel like winter here.
Well, I tell you, we really did have major, major winds and other weather events that we've had just through the weekend that we'll get a chance to address later in the broader context. But I want our listeners to know that this isn't just an account of a notable storm. This is, and I'm going to quote because I couldn't say it better myself, an epic story of nature's power and how it played out hour by hour for 9 days. So it's kind of a thriller drama with characters that some of us kind of know, Mayor Bloomberg, Chris Christie, and other professionals, but a lot of people that I wasn't aware of and we didn't hear about. So before we get into the personalities and the storm and the 9 days, can you give us an idea of kind of set the stage of kind of why you were interested in doing this and what drew you to it?
Sure. You know, I think like a lot of Americans, I watched with shock and awe and sometimes even horror as the storm not just marched up the East Coast and obviously decimated places like New York and New Jersey, but what really interested to me was just how flat-footed as a nation we were when it came to dealing with the storm, everything from issuing initial advisories and warnings all the way up to our response to the storm. So very quickly, the book became not just a narrative of Superstorm Sandy, but also an inquiry into what I think is really the failing infrastructure of our national meteorological system.
Which becomes more evident, all the systems that are in place to make us feel comfortable, safe, and secure are coming into question at this particular time. Maybe start by setting the stage from the International Space Station, from the as you refer in the book.
Sure. It was an immense storm. It's still, and for quite some time, I think will be the largest storm on record, 1,000 miles in diameter, such that the scientists up in the International Space Station were literally watching it almost as if it was out their window. That's just how immense it was. The damage that this storm did to the United States covered a size larger than all of Europe. And really that epic quality of the storm is important, and I think really going to be the future of our storms, and we need to get ready for that as a nation.
Yeah, no, and this is the book is a very interesting confluence of both the human drama, which you did so well, and the technical and more in-depth analysis. So maybe start as it starts in the human part about, you know, I think by the time that most of us became aware, it had already created quite a huge devastation in the Caribbean coast. I don't remember up until then hearing much about it. So maybe you can start with your narrative as that unfolded.
Sure. And that was really interesting to me, was how contentious this storm was before most Americans even knew it existed.
Exactly. I don't, I you know, watching with moderate interest, I would say at that point, I didn't hear it, you know, reflected as it was in your book.
The storm began as a very typical late season hurricane deep in the very southern Caribbean, almost off the coast of Venezuela, really. And it was, you know, your classic hurricane. And we as a nation and the National Hurricane Center, National Weather Service, responded to it as it would any other hurricane. But very quickly, two things happened. First of all, initially, there was enormous divergence in the hurricane models in terms of saying where the storm was going to go. The National Hurricane Center uses about 40 models to predict the track of storms and also the intensity. And 9 days out, really up until about 4 days out, there was only one model, the European model, that said that the storm was going to make this bizarre and incredibly unlikely left hook and collide with the mid-Atlantic. And the meteorologists all thought that just couldn't possibly happen. They thought the model had gotten it really wrong. And it wasn't until really October 24th, October 25th, that other models started to join in this prediction. The other thing, and I think perhaps the more important thing, was that the storm very quickly began to take on these hybrid characteristics. Hurricanes draw their energy from warm moisture in the ocean and the ocean atmosphere. Nor'easters draw their energy from temperature differentials up in the atmosphere. As Hurricane Sandy began to collide with this ginormous nor'easter that was moving across the United States, by all sort of logical accounts, the two storms should have canceled each other out and kind of just created a soupy mess. But what they did was they collided and became this sort of hybrid monster that borrowed from the worst attributes of both. And when that happened, we saw this real crisis in our weather system and our emergency management response, where because of the way the National Hurricane Center had been delineated in terms of its responsibilities, they literally couldn't issue watches, warnings, and advisories for Sandy once it became this hybrid storm. And that created a really serious domino effect that had long-lasting implications for everything from evacuations in New York City to very current insurance disputes that are happening right now, where insurance companies are saying they don't need to pay for the damage because the storm wasn't a proper hurricane.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and that's what you go into in the book, is talking about the different governmental responses and difficulty assigning who is responsible for and how to go forward in the future. So why don't you start with a little bit of the human? Well, first of all, you describe Chris Lancey. And I have to, first of all, make a comment that his name is spelled L-A-N-D-S-E-A.
He was born a meteorologist.
I am telling you. I read that in the book and I reread it and went, really? So very interesting. But give us an idea of some of the characters that start to become influential, because in the book, as you develop it with characters and character develop, it becomes much more human and less about the actual operations and more about the people operating it. So
that really was my aim. I really wanted it to be a very human story. And I had the great opportunity to spend a lot of time at both the National Hurricane Center and several of the National Weather Service branch offices, and finding out how these meteorologists do their work is really remarkable. And they're fantastic characters, and I don't mean to belittle their work by calling them characters. They're fantastic humans.
Yeah.
I also spent time with the hurricane hunters, this wonderful, heroic, unsung branch of the Air Force Reserves who literally fly every hour on the hour directly through these storms in order to get the data that allows meteorologists to do their work. So I wanted to tell their story. I think that's part of the infrastructure, the unseen infrastructure that most Americans don't see on a daily basis. And it's really important for us to understand how it works. I also wanted to tell the stories, sometimes tragic, sometimes heroic, of people who were involved in the storm as well, everyone from Coast Guard rescuers to officials like Mayor Bloomberg, and then average Americans who had to make life and death decisions, decisions that we all make, and we don't necessarily know we're making them, and really to call attention to how we deal with risk, not just as a nation, but also as individuals.
Well, before we get into some of the personalities, I do need to make a quick aside after we were commenting on Chris Lancy. Speaking of, this might be an appropriate time to, and an interesting point to tell us about naming hurricanes and the process around that, just names in general. So if you can digress for just a minute and talk to us about how that came to be and how we utilize it today.
Sure. It's a fairly recent phenomenon, actually, and it was only just a few decades ago, actually, that we really started adopting this practice as we know it today. It was an Australian meteorologist who first had the idea to name hurricanes, and he was something of a political curmudgeon, and so he would name storms after his least favorite politicians. And the idea caught on that as sort of average citizens, we could make more sense of storms instead of sort of, you know, storm N1320, we called it Bob or Steve or Sandy. And so we started this convention, and initially, meteorologists were just using random words from the alphabet. So the first year that we were naming storms, about 4 or 5 decades ago, they came up with these bizarre names like zebra and sugar and love, and sort of a tragic idea, really, that Hurricane Love would be striking
yeah.
us. And then the idea became that we would name them after women, and that convention held for several decades. And then as the Equal Rights Movement grew in strength during the late 1960s and 1970s, we decided to adopt male names as well. And now there's an incredibly Byzantine process that goes every year to sort of decide what names we'll use to replace large storms. Names like Katrina and Sandy get retired after they're used. And one thing that I think is really interesting, too, is that we name storms what people consider culturally appropriate names for different areas. So while we may have very sort of almost sort of Americanized names here, if you look at typhoons in the South Pacific, they'll have names that are very sort of common there as well, too. The idea that we somehow need to get these storms to resonate with the populations that are going to experience them.
Well, and here was an important point. Name for me the top three hurricanes.
In terms of
devastation and size and memorable.
Well, that's something of a dispute, but certainly Katrina still reigns
and
supreme.
Andrew.
Sandy is next in terms of expense.
Yep.
And then some people would say Andrew. Some people would say Hugo.
And my point being, we do know those. They are collectively in our consciousness, those words. And we do have if the point was to help us remember in a very specific manner where they occurred, how bad they were, and whatever, boy, you just can't say Katrina and not know.
And that's part of what I think the initial confusion, it was almost a joke about Sandy, is they thought, you know, how could a storm with a name like Sandy possibly do anything? And there was a study that was issued earlier this year that suggested that, in fact, Americans are more likely to evacuate for male-named storms than female-named storms because the male names seem more menacing to us. And I thought that was a fascinating exploration of social science and gender, ultimately.
It truly is. Well, you have in the book that CNN Rob's Marciano announced that the network would no longer use the word Frankenstorm when reporting on the hurricane, following a directive from its management not to trivialize their coverage. We are refraining due to the severity of the storm, he tweeted to his 27,000 followers. Inside the studios, severe weather expert Chad Myers sent a text ordering the removal of a banner that used that word. It's a term not appropriate for a storm that's already killed more than 20 people. It's too big of an event to make fun of. So there was that moment where they were kind of, you know, Frankenstorm, like it was some, you know, minor Halloween treat. Rather than the severity that was coming. So, yeah, you were right.
And it was interesting to see, really, in terms of the media response, and that was one thing that I covered in the book as well, too.
Absolutely.
And it was really interesting to see that, you know, that sort of almost sort of jovial response to the storm transcended politics. It was on conservative radio. It was on, you know, what you might call liberal radio. And that's part of the, I think, the falling down process that happened during this particular storm. It became such a confused event for people. They didn't know where to go get the information. Information wasn't coming where they expected it to. And that's part of how we ended up in this place where we were so unprepared to deal with the storm as it arrived.
Yes. And the tenor, like you said, the tenor that it was addressed with was again, calling it Frankenstorm and having to be told after, you know, people have died and the devastation is coming, oops, you know, let's get serious. I just need to, before we continue, remind our listeners that you're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM. And today I'm speaking with Catherine Miles about her new book, 9 Days Inside Hurricane Sandy Superstorm. Before we get to it getting to land here, and speaking of names, maybe give us some highlights about Robin Wallbridge, the captain of the tall ship Bounty, and what was going on there.
This is one of the very tragic stories of the book, and it really became emblematic of how so many of us make decisions when faced with disaster and crisis. The Bounty was a really beautiful wooden ship built initially for the film Mutiny of the Bounty, starring Marlon Brando. And the ship had taken on a new career, giving dockside tours for fans of tall ships and maritime history. And the captain, Robin Wallbridge, was based with his crew in New London, Connecticut on October 25th. They were destined for St. Petersburg, Florida, which is the one time and still many people consider the traditional home of the Bounty. And he looked at the weather forecasts. He thought he had a handle on what the storm was going to do. He had successfully sailed the ship through two other hurricanes, and so he assumed that he could make it through this particular storm, but very quickly was bested by the storm. The storm sank very tragically on October 29th off the coast of Hatteras, North Carolina, and what resulted was one of the most dangerous and quite possibly the most expensive rescue in Coast Guard history, and miraculously, all of the crew survived except for Captain Wallbridge and one very sort of tragic figure in the book, a young woman named Claudine Christian.
Yes, who had some reservations before, and yet there was this collective. I mean, again, the book does a great job of at several points, talking about the human understanding that once adopted an opinion, it draws all things to support and agree with it, and that we justify what we already believe or have decided. This is a theme throughout the book in people not necessarily, just doing that, supporting their already preconceived idea rather than branching out from that.
That's very well said, and that's what the risk assessment specialists told me time and time again, scholars and professors who specialize in this sort of work. And for me, that's why the Bounty became so emblematic and really kind of metaphoric in the book as a whole. The very same decision that Captain Wallbridge was making was the same decision that Mayor Bloomberg was making for New York City. He had this very strange press conference 2 days before the storm made landfall where he told New Yorkers that it was fine. Everything was going to be fine. We were going to dodge a bullet. President Obama offered support in the form of FEMA, and I told him we don't need it. In fact, we will go help other communities. And we saw that with the people within the storm zone. The most chilling statistic for me in this entire book is the fact that 70% of the people who were ordered to evacuate during the storm chose not to evacuate.
Yeah.
And that says a lot, I think, about how we make decisions when confronted with risk.
And as you stated in the book, in some of Staten Island community, which was the hardest hit, the number was even higher than 70%.
That's right. And that's what, you know, as Americans, we make these decisions all of the time. And we just sort of assume that it's not going to happen to us. Because so few of us have been in a catastrophic weather event, we assume it can't happen. But what we're seeing right now is a changing weather milieu that none of us is really prepared for. We have you know, we have tornadoes in Washington State. We have hurricanes hitting places like New York. We have a huge insurge of earthquakes happening, maybe due, in fact, to human-made behaviors as well, too. And so this is a new weather paradigm, and it demands a new weather response.
And that's, I think that's the critical issue that when we'll talk more about the evolution of Superstorm Sandy, but I think, again, to broaden out near the end of our conversation to the future and where we are now in terms of these upcoming weather events. So back to where we are in terms of the actual Superstorm Sandy. I think for most of our listeners and your readers, quite possibly, it starts with Chris Christie saying, "Get the hell off the beach," was when people started to understand what was going on, or at least being aware that something was going on.
He emerged as a very decisive figure during Sandy, and ultimately in my book Superstorm as well, too. He was willing to take very sort of significant, very aggressive action in the face of the storm. And he became, in that regard, a very contrasting figure to Mayor Bloomberg.
Bloomberg, yeah.
One of the reasons, I believe, that Governor Christie was so aggressive in his behavior is he was receiving outstanding information from the National Weather Service based in Mount Holly, which does the weather for both New Jersey, Delaware, and then Philadelphia as well. And there was one really sort of key heroic figure who I focus on in the book.
Yes, tell us. Yeah, that's important.
This is the head meteorologist at that National Weather Service office. He's a man by the name of Gary Szasadzki, and he saw very early on the potential for threat, really, to the Mid-Atlantic. And he had a very sort of forward-thinking vision of the storm. And he said, look, you know, it really doesn't matter where the eye of the storm makes landfall. The storm is 1,000 miles in diameter. We're going to get hit, and we need to do something. And he broke ranks, really, with National Weather Service protocol, and in a lot of ways risked both his reputation and ultimately his job in order to issue these very personal pleas. He included his cell phone, his home number. He said, look, you know, this is Gary talking to you, and your life is at risk, and I don't want you to die, and I don't care if you're mad at me. This very sort of emotional, very human language. And undoubtedly, he saved dozens, if not hundreds, of lives. And I think he showed through his bravery, his willingness to risk all of this in order to save people, that some of these very sort of narrow protocols that we have in place for things like emergency management and weather prediction don't allow us to get the message out that we really need to.
Yes, and it also highlights for me, when I was reading it, the totally maligned and often discredited public servants and government workers. I you know, in watching, just to infuse this Ebola for a minute, just to watching the nurses, watching the people who are the I don't even whistleblowers, just the average person working hard to say, wait a minute, this is important. Listen to us and take, like you said, the chances that he did on a very personal level, and just being that conscientious and concerned.
Right, and there are some remarkable similarities to the current Ebola crisis, if you want to call it a crisis, and Hurricane Sandy, and our response to both as a nation, I think, have some very chilling parallels. And it's a question, I think, in a lot of ways, of whether we want to invest in being preventative or whether we want to invest in being responsive. And in both the case of Sandy and Ebola, we've taken a very responsive approach rather than front-loading and being preventive.
And again, it's because I think it's become this deterioration and questioning of civic officials, of their competency, and not rewarding necessarily their effort for being prepared in advance or giving them the support they need to go forward and say, well, And again, and maybe it's even broader than that. Maybe it comes back to science and global warming and our lack of appreciation. I know that that common, well, I'm not a scientist, or and yet these are the people voting on. And
right.
And we are looking to make the decisions. So, you know, I don't even know what that means when they say I'm not a scientist or I'm not a meteorologist. Well, then find one, be one, listen to one, you know.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, we have got, as a nation, we have to start thinking about prioritization and where we're putting our money, where we're putting our time and our best efforts. You know, for me, what this book very quickly became was a book about infrastructure crisis. And what I discovered in my investigation and in my reporting is just how serious this crisis has become. We currently have 500 unstaffed positions in the National Weather Service, and nearly 400 of those positions are what are deemed emergency essential. These are the forecasters and the technicians who come in during storms and are running the radar, are running the satellites, are issuing the watches and warnings. The budget has not just flatlined, it's decreased 8.3%. They're dealing with Doppler radar that crashes. We're dealing with outmoded satellites that are long beyond their lifespan. We're dealing with technology that has broken and left us in a position where we have to borrow from other countries. And this has created what is ultimately a national security crisis and really a crisis of personal safety as well.
Yes. Now, I want to remind our listeners, as we continue, that you are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland. And today I'm speaking with Catherine Miles about her new book, 9 Days Inside Hurricane Sandy Superstorm. And again, what the book does so well is it's not just an accounting of the dramatic events that led up to this and occurred, but as we are speaking now about the ramifications and the future in terms of most of our infrastructure that's designed and developed to help us cope with what is going to be part of our future and the changes that are occurring. So, but before we get too far out, I do want you to be able to talk a little bit about the actual Chris Christie's warning, and then kind of give us a little more about what happened on the ground and was occurring starting there.
Well, you know, when I talked to officials, a lot of officials said we felt like we were in the fog of war at the time. There were strict protocols in place. A lot of emergency managers, especially in New York City, had drilled, assuming that they were going to be receiving information, especially about storm surge, from the National Hurricane Center. As soon as Sandy began to take on this hybrid characteristic, the National Hurricane Center couldn't issue the watches and warnings. And so they met with officials at the National Weather Service. They made the decision, what some of them told me they felt was the least lousy of three really lousy options. And they made the decision to hand off responsibility to these regional National Weather Service offices. And these are offices that are staffed by outstanding meteorologists. They're small. A lot of them are understaffed. And they don't necessarily have the megaphone voice that the National Hurricane Center has to say, listen, you need to listen to us right now. And so there was a lot of confusion about where the information was coming from. Some people were referring to the storm as a hurricane. Some people were referring to it as an extratropical system. That's not a word that really rolls off the tongue or resonates mm-hmm. with people. Some people were saying it's high wind warnings. Some people were saying it's tropical storm warnings. And so there was this enormous amount of information, some of it misinformation. And you saw a lot of confusion on the parts of residents in these areas. Governor Christie's decision was to take to the airwaves and use incredibly strong language. You know, he loves those sort of colloquialisms. You know, yeah. Don't be stupid. Stupid is what stupid does. And, get the hell off the beach. And I think in a way the shock value of that language really broke through.
I agree. I think that's when people on the West Coast who didn't have a vested interest other than, you know, the obvious, but nobody personally on the ground, I will say they stood up and take notice. And
yeah.
said, oh, well, yeah, you know, that's, really, get serious.
You know, we live in such a democratization of media and news. And that's what the meteorologist told me as well, is they said, you know, look, it used to be the case that we were the only people with the radar. And you kind of had to come to us
yeah.
to figure out what was going on. But now, you know, it's so accessible for so many people. And so, especially when we factor in new media, social media, mm-hmm. we have, you know, all sorts of armchair meteorologists out there. And what they told me is they said, you know, we used to be able to kind of hold our cards close to our chest and wait until we really had a consistent, articulate message to give to the general public. But we can't do that anymore because we get scooped by amateur meteorologists and by the local news. And so it's that much harder for us to get our message out to the public.
Well, and the problem with that and the dilution of it or amplification either way is confusing, because if every little snowstorm turns into 24-hour coverage of the person jogging that slipped, it by definition demeans the importance of when it really is important and critical, when there is information that's necessary. I think that's, you know, that's another thing that's been confusing. Like you say, with 24/7 of news, what they're standing out there with an umbrella, you know, wind pouring down, rather than giving you the accurate information that you might want to be able to do something.
And that's the great irony here, is that what demographic studies have told news channels and meteorologists over and over again is that we eat these stories up. We're voracious, you know, eaters of natural disaster stories. We love it. And that's why they lead with those stories, is mm-hmm. they know it's great for ratings. We'll tune in. And the irony is, as much as we love to tune in, we're loath to act. And I think that that's a really interesting sort of divergence there in terms of what we like to consume versus what we like to do.
Yeah. No, it's very instructive, and you can feel it generated through the book, both the confusion, the wanting to act, and not being clear again. I remember through this, even Jon Stewart in The Daily Show saying, we don't know, but let's err on this side. And, you know, confusion around that, and watching it on the West Coast going, wow. So this is kind of a deal. This is, you know, serious. It also may be instructive going forward that you said in the book that Sandy is the third costliest U.S. natural catastrophe after Hurricanes Katrina, which was $48.7 billion with a B, and Andrew, $25.6 billion.
Sandy
with
is actually ahead of Andrew. Sandy is number two, only behind Katrina.
Okay. This was based on private insurance losses only. And then the business accounted for almost half, which is an unusual thing. 47.6% of the privately insured losses were from the from Sandy. So, you know, again, going forward, I would think that a mayor, anybody who's connected to the business community, will again take notice not just of the residential and homeowner part of the commercial claims, but the business being impacted.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. And the response too. What we've seen in the last few years is a historic amount of movement in terms of emergency management plans for all communities. There were two very decisive class action lawsuits in the state of California very recently, where people with disabilities and functional needs successfully sued and said, look, we're at a disproportionate risk. There is no emergency management plan for us in this community. New York just settled an enormous class action lawsuit, millions of dollars, for the exact same reason, where people said, look, you know, during Hurricane Sandy, people with functional needs and disabilities had 6 hours between when Mayor Bloomberg ordered evacuations to when mass transportation for people with needs, special needs, was shut down.
Yeah.
There's another massive class action lawsuit inspired by this one that's currently in the courts in Washington, D.C.
Yes.
And so we're seeing people really start to stand up and say, you know, am I safe? Do we have a plan in the case that we need to move me or my grandmother or a disabled veteran or whoever the case may be?
Yeah.
And what we're finding is we don't necessarily have these plans.
Well, again, we are running out of time, and I want to encourage our people, our listeners, in this day and age of global warming and increasing dramatic weather events, in the last few minutes, I just want our listeners to know that I hope that we all stay dry but not too dry, and that it rains but not too much, and that we can fund and come together as a country to make sure that we, if we can't avoid these events, that at least we can be more prepared in the future. I want to thank you. We've been speaking with Catherine Miles about her new book coming out just in advance of the anniversary of Superstorm Sandy, 9 days inside Hurricane Sandy Superstorm. Thank you so much for being with us. I really appreciate the book and your time.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me today.
All right. This is Michelle Schroeder-Fletcher, KBOO 90.7 FM Portland.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or wilkincpas.com.
This KBOO program has been made possible, also made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Aladdin Theater, presenting New Year's Eve with Hot Tuna, performing acoustic blues on December 31st. Tickets and information for New Year's Eve with Hot Tuna are available at aladdin-theater.com.
Don't let Rupert Murdoch control your newscasts. The KBOO Evening News provides breaking news about local issues, from water fluoridation to immigration raids. We bring you daily coverage of what's going on in Portland, Cascadia, and around the world. Tune in every weekday at 5 for the KBOO Evening News on KBOO, your community radio station.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Fall 2014 Portland Debtors Assembly, taking place Thursday, October 30th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Center for Intercultural Organizing in Portland. Participants will learn about the debt system, listen to personal stories on how debt affects our daily lives, connect with groups working to redefine our funding priorities, and organize. Again, that's the Fall 2014 Portland Debtors Assembly, Thursday, October 30th, 7 to 9 p.m. at the Center for Intercultural Organizing, 700 North Killingsworth Street in Portland. More information may be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland Eye Care, a Southeast Portland optometrist providing eye exams, contact lenses, and medical eye care, as well as eyewear from independent designers.
Portland Eye Care is located at 41st and Southeast Division Street in Portland and online at eyepdx.com.
This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Aladdin Theater, presenting an evening with Leon Russell, Wednesday, October 29th. Tickets and information for an evening with Leon Russell on October 29th are available at aladdin-theater.com. And now stay tuned. Disability Awareness is off today. Instead, we'll hear Food Sleuth Radio with guest Karen Collins, nutrition advisor to the American Institute for Cancer Research, explaining what we know, what we don't know about nutrition and cancer prevention. Stay tuned.
Hi, welcome to Food Sleuth Radio, where we help you think beyond your plate. I'm Melinda Hemmelgarn, a registered dietitian and investigative nutritionist on a mission to connect the dots between food, health, and agriculture and find food truth. And today it is my pleasure to welcome a fellow dietitian. Karen Collins is an award-winning registered dietitian who takes nutrition from daunting to doable. She has served as nutrition advisor to the American Institute for Cancer Research for over 25 years. She is truly an expert on nutrition to reduce cancer risk. That's what we're going to be really focusing on today. She has a terrific education. She has a bachelor's degree in dietetics from Purdue University and a master's degree in nutrition from Cornell. Karen, welcome.
Oh, thank you, Melinda. I'm delighted to be here with you.
Well, I heard a webinar that you did for your fellow dietitians as a continuing education seminar, and it was about antioxidants, and it was so excellent and thorough that I thought, oh, gosh, please be my guest and help us understand this complex issue. So why don't we just start out first, and let me know how and why you got into this path of nutrition. What was it that sparked your interest in nutrition and cancer?
Well, I was in-